on the show, our last guest, you know, it's hard to follow Bobby Hoyt. So,
yeah.
And we actually. Are you all right? What's wrong?
I felt a great disturbance in the force, as if millions of voices suddenly cried out in terror and were suddenly silenced.
My name is Celeste from Catskill, New York, and you're listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM.
Listen to music and voices. Listen to art and discussion. Listen to work and play. Listen to eat and drink. Listen to up and down. Listen to noise and fun. Listen to purple and green. Listen to pink and blue. Listen to a heart rainbow. Listen to wizards and witches. Listen to jazz play. Listen to dogs and mice. Listen to Rome and Italy. Listen to Mars and Venus. Listen to the planet. Listen to the planet. Listen to ladies and dumplings. Listen to books. Listen to teeth and trunks. Listen to bath time and nap time. Listen to Kaizen and Violet. Listen to Stars and Stripes. Listen to Texas and listen to bells and waterfalls. Listen to churches and steeple. Dance and sing and listen and bells. Listen to making things, stripes and zigzags. Listen to clouds and leaves, bike riding and zigzagging. No, listen to bike riding and curving. Listen to the radio going on and on. Listen to the radio going on and on. Listen to the radio WGXC.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Letitia of Oakland, California. WGXC supporters care deeply about Creative Community Radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to WGXC.org/donate. and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
WGXC underwriting is provided in part by the Olana Partnership, presenting Third Thursday, a day of tours and programs topped off by Tunes with a View. Visitors can experience global sounds while taking in the views of the Hudson Valley. This month featuring the Afro-Caribbean Brazilian group Heard World on Thursday, August 21st from 12 to 7 p.m. All are welcome. Details at olana.org/thirdthursdays.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Friday, August 15th. Local early morning temperatures range from 56 degrees in Steventown to 65 in Red Hook. Regional average soil temperature is 71 degrees. Air quality will be moderate and pollen levels will be high. Today is going to be pretty warm and very sunny. The only saving grace is dew points will be in the lower 60s. We get a high temperature of 86 at 3 p.m. Overnight, temperatures dip to 68 degrees. Tomorrow, dew points almost reaching the 70s. It will feel pretty humid and temperatures max out at 84 degrees at 3 p.m. Some afternoon showers are expected. Sunday, we get a chance of rain all day long with a high of 87 at 3 p.m. Monday is probably dry with a high of 75. Today's tide schedule is low tide at 2:28 a.m., high tide at 8:08 a.m., low tide again at 2:31 p.m., then high tide once again at 8:41 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 82 degrees and the tide strength is average. Sunset today will be at 7:44 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 6 o'clock a.m. Looking way up, we see X-class flare chances are at 5%. Plasma winds will be average at 465 kilometers per second with a thin density of 3 protons per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently solar max standard with an S2 level noise floor. There are no chances of aurora this evening. The current sunspot number is 170. This has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
Exploring science in the sea. If you want to avoid sharks, then steer clear of the mountains. No, we're not talking about the next Sharknado movie. It's underwater mountains called seamounts that you want to avoid. A recent study found there were 40 times more sharks around a couple of shallow seamounts than in the surrounding open ocean. Researchers spent about 20 months perusing three seamounts near Ascension Island, a lonely spot in the South Atlantic Ocean. The peaks of two of the seamounts rose to within a few hundred feet of the surface, while the third was deeper. Scientists studied life in the region with underwater video cameras, surface counts, and sonar scans, and they placed tracking devices on several sharks and tunas. They found that all forms of life were more abundant around the two shallower seamounts, from the tiniest organisms all the way up to top-level predators. But the higher up the food web, the greater the abundance compared to the open ocean. Some of the tagged sharks and tunas hung around a single seamount. A few others made appearances at both, and one intrepid shark journeyed up to 85 miles out to sea. The researchers aren't sure why there's such a concentration of sharks and other life at the seamounts. Currents may push more prey up the sides of the mountains, attracting larger fish. Or perhaps the currents just make it harder for prey to escape. Whatever the reason, the sharks just loved hanging around these underwater mountains. Science in the Sea is a production of the University of Texas Marine Science Institute at Port Aransas and is available as a weekly podcast at scienceinthesea.org. I'm Holly Brawley.
FM.
Acra, Hudson, Catskill.
Hello, this is Meredith Cooey, Wavefarm Radio Program Director, and I am super excited for this conversation with a bunch of folks from PS21 to talk about the rest of the season and a couple of upcoming performances. So I am joined over Zoom by Vallejo Gantner, who is the newly appointed Artistic and Executive Director of PS21 Center for Contemporary Performance in Chatham. And I'm also joined by Samantha Shea, who is an artist, performer, and director who is presenting the U.S. premiere of her work, Life in This House is Over, this weekend. And also joined by Julianne Stanzik, who is performing in Life in This House is Over. And then also Seth Honor, who leads the production studio Collider, which is presenting its work Arch at the end of the month during the two-day festival Common Ground at PS21. So hello, Vallejo.
Hey, Meredith. Nice to meet you. Thanks for having us on today.
Yeah. Hi, Samantha.
Hi.
Hi, Julianne.
Hello. Happy to be here.
And hi, Seth.
Hi, Meredith.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time. And as I said, I'm really excited about this conversation. So, Vallejo, let's start with you. How is this season at PS21 going?
It's amazing. It's my first season, so there's been a kind of whole series of learning experiences of understanding our audience better and the possibilities not only of the theatre that many of your listeners will know, I think, but also of the whole landscape and grounds that the theatre sits on, which is, you know, 100 acres of creek flats and woods and meadows and ponds, and we've started kind of bringing some of the performances and the edgy contemporary work that we're known for out into those new spaces and also using the theatre in really different ways, which has been really exciting for all of us.
I'm curious what, because I had only seen the recent performance Feminine by the Kyle Marshall choreographer,
yeah,
which I loved, but that's the only way that I've seen the theater being used. What are some of the different ways you're talking about?
So there is that front-on way, but then the Ground Tone Festival that happened a few weeks ago, we pulled the seating half out and all the performances happened in the middle of the space. Lina Lapalite, who presented a work during that festival as well, happened over in the meadow and in and around the dance barn. We've had shows that use the mode field next to the theatre for performances. And for Common Ground, in a couple of weeks, a company from France called Basinga presenting a work on the old tent site where Judy Grunberg, our founder, originally put on her festival. And Arch will be in the theatre with all the seats retracted, happening under the pavilion space itself. So there's really a sense of activating all the possibilities of the facility, rather than keeping ourselves into the conventional stage relationship. Having said that, it's a really beautiful theatre to sit, as you would have found with Carl Marshall, to sit and as we will this weekend with Life in This House Is Over, to sit and watch a performance as the sun sets. It's magic.
So were performances and installations not happening throughout the grounds previously?
Well, I wasn't here, so I can't say. but I think they were. I think less so, and certainly I think as we look forward to 2026 and beyond, as the programming that I'm bringing to the table starts to take greater effect, we'll see increased use of that and increased programming in different spaces, and more work, I hope, that is in a really tangible way inspired by both the human community that exists in Columbia County and the Upper Hudson Valley, but also by the non-human kind of ecosystems and that exist in around the Hudson River and the history of the Hudson River, but also around very specifically our kind of site.
Yeah, I didn't realize that there were ongoing public programs there too, outside of the performances. Like, Sayre told me, dance classes there, Sayre Mansfield I'm talking about. So yeah, I'm curious about the relationship between the community and PS21 and what you hope to, cultivate during your...
For sure. So year round we have dance classes and we've just started a program of sound baths and there are two sculptural works that are on the grounds already. It's also open, not 24/7, but dawn to dusk, I think, for people to walk their dogs or hike on the trails and explore that kind of the several different kind of ecosystems that we've got there. For me, some of the most interesting work that I see being made at the moment is not only participatory in terms of how it relates to its audience, giving the audience kind of agency in how they think about how they approach the work, but also is often co-authored in relationship to the community around it, working with kids, with grown-ups, with people who might be in a particular vocation or of a particular age group, and working with them to bring out their stories. And in other cases, for instance, we have a Norwegian company coming in the autumn for a residency period to begin development of a work that, at least at its beginnings, is based on a kind of very deep listening to the history of the Hudson Valley. And they make these extraordinary shows that are kinetic sculptures and music pieces and performances that are based in part on living in and kind of a profound listening process to the people, the nature, the history, whether that's an industrial history, pre-colonial or current, of places. And so I'm really excited for them to be kind of living in the community for a few weeks, talking to people, visiting the river, visiting the old factory sites, and kind of exploring. And I hope, anyway, more and more work will be kind of based on that sort of process, on that makes the very best of the kind of international work that we can find connect in a more profound way to the year-round residents as much as the people who are here just for weekends or for holidays.
I'm so excited to learn more about that project when it comes here. I have to say, a lot of the work that I've done in my own practice is very place-based and working with community. And I think of community radio, right, as like place-based, site-specific performance also, right?
Yep.
And engagement. So I'm really looking forward to hearing about that. And speaking of participatory, I'll turn to Samantha, because part of your weekend's programming involves a participatory event with folk singing, traditional singing from all across the world, and then your premiere of the, you know, dance theater work, Life in This House is Over. So I would love to hear about both of those events, and also how they're in relationship to each other. I'm really curious about that.
Yeah. So the piece Life in This House is Over is very inspired by a lot of research I've been doing. I'm actually originally from Massachusetts, grew up not super far from here. But I've been living in Germany now for 4 years, which is wild. But a lot of research into some of my inspirations, such as Pina Bausch, which you mentioned, as well as the lineages of Grotowski and Cantor and the sort of post-Grotowski lineage, which relates a lot to the folk singing. So Life in This House is Over is a piece about grief. It's a very interdisciplinary piece. There's text, there's dance, there's singing, you know, and I think that I like to create a space for the audience to sort of complete the work with their own experience. It's theirs to take, you know? And I also think, okay, it was really funny. I talked to an astrologer to give me a reading for this week so I could like plan my rehearsals. So yeah. That's the thing that I do. Wasn't planning to say it on the radio, but why not? And she said something really interesting about grief. And I was like, oh, you just explained this thing about my piece that I don't know how to talk about, which is why maybe I don't make text-based theater. Like there's something where there, you know, we live in a world that is very full of suffering, you know, and trauma. And I think I like to make pieces that kind of unsharpen and like soften the body of the audience somehow so that they can feel grief without necessarily banging them over the head with the horrors that be, if that makes sense. So there's this aesthetic beauty and there's this kind of poetry about it, which I think invites the unsharpening, you know, of the body, hopefully, which relates very much to the folk singing and to participatory, like to it being participatory. And there's folk singing both in Life in This House is Over, and then there's a concert, which is not just like traditional polyphonic music. We also have some contemporary original compositions from other pieces I've made. And we've actually like layered them with polyphonic songs in ways like we've never done before. So that's going to be really fun and cool and crazy. But, you know, I'm also very, like, as a theater artist, I really never forget that, like, theater started as ritual, you know, and a lot of the origins of theater were, like, lamentation rituals, funerals. I try to keep that in my heart and mind when I'm making something. So both of those things exist, like in Life in This House Is Over. And yeah, with the concert, I'm really excited. And we are like teaching the audience a song, which will be really cool. A really beautiful Georgian song that we always sing when we're at parties. We always like we get together and drink wine and sing that song. So and singing really like it does something to people, you know. So I think I'm also interested in sort of the blending of aesthetics as well, because a lot of the post-Grotowski work, a lot of polyphonic music became a part of that lineage. And it was really exciting to me to bring that, but put it next to a reference of like a Bausch image, you know, which is so different. And also to, you know, compose around it, to put it in a new context. So we'll be doing that in both pieces. And also in the concert, in the afternoon, the free concert, we're also going to be doing some Ukrainian lamentation, which I think will be really timely and really moving. So yeah, that's a bit of it.
I have so many thoughts. I think one of the where my mind is bringing me right now is thinking about singing as, you know, a vagal nerve toning too, right? And so, you know, one of the things for trauma survivors is thinking about toning the vagal nerve. And one thing you can do is singing. I know for me, when I'm feeling pretty in my feelings, I like to belt out 90s jams in my car, you know? And there's something about that, like opening the throat and like doing that. I don't know why I had never thought that that is maybe what all of these centuries of people have been doing, right? Is expressing through that way and with the breath. And I really love that you're bringing that to folks. There's something I get so embarrassed by group singing, actually, like group clapping and group singing. I'm like, I don't know if I can do this. Like, this is a very solitary experience for me. And so when I'm watching, you know, dance and theater, when I get to be like with my own experience, like, I really appreciate that. So that's interesting that you're bringing both of those things together so that people can have like one or the other. What do you feel about that sort of group dynamic, I guess, as opposed to, you know, sitting in the seat?
Yeah. It's interesting as well, like, to hear you say group singing stresses me out, because it makes me think about like being a kid in Massachusetts and being in choir, you know, and being like, oh, am I singing it right? You know, and I think that's the thing about these songs is that they're meant to be sung by non-singers, right? Like, they're for people. You know, they come from communities, right? And I think that's inherently different, you know, from my school years. And as well, I mean, the other thing is we actually had, even though there's obviously singers in this piece and there's dancers in this piece, we had the whole cast singing together the whole time. Mm-hmm. And also had people who were always told I could never singing, which was really gorgeous. But I do think that once we break through that feeling, like you said, of group singing being nerve wracking, it does tone the vagal nerve eventually. You know, and I think the ear does automatically end up adjusting to we find our place in the song always if we listen. And then in terms of like participatory versus viewer, sorry, I have a Chihuahua here and she's having thoughts. You know, I think that line can be kind of blurry for me, depending on the performance, you know? Like, it can be that something that's very immersive is not. Like, that sometimes we go to an immersive piece and the audience is told what to do the whole time, right? And so it's sort of like my experience is now being more managed than when I'm in a seat, you know? And nothing against it, but I think that it's always blurry, you know, to me. And of course, there's something wonderful about acknowledging what a space is and working from that. And I think that's not done enough. And that's where I really applaud Vallejo's ideas around that. I think that's so cool. And I think that the piece I'm doing, which is like in a proscenium, you know, you sit in a seat and you watch something. I think it's a very intentional choice for me. It's not a given that that's the way I constructed the performance, because it is kind of like, the audience is washed with a constellation of different things, and they need their own space to process it. You know, I almost feel if we were too close to the audience, mm-hmm. it would be too confronting. Like when you're doing a piece about grief, like it actually is really very intimate to have your own space to contemplate it. So that's where I think that sort of distance actually allows the emotional process to unfold. And not every performance needs that, but maybe this one does. And, you know, there's also moments in the piece where people are very obscured, you know, like you're just seeing shadows. It's not a traditional American play where someone is like coming on stage and having a monologue, although there is a monologues, but it's an environment to inhabit in a way, which is also, I think, something Bausch did very well. You know, Cafe Mueller is an environment that you witness, right? So I think, you know, some people may come from that piece feeling as though they deeply participated, and some may come away thinking, I sat in a chair and watched this thing that I didn't feel close to. That's for them, you know, but I definitely think giving them that personal space, that's sort of almost like safety net of the proscenium, is quite elegant for this particular show.
Yeah. I just, before I lose this thought, two thoughts. I totally thought of Cafe Mueller when I was watching the trailer. I love that. And this, what you're talking about with grief and what feels to me like witnessing, that makes me think too, Seth, of Arch. And basically the audience, viewer, whatever term you want to use, witnessing people exerting so much effort to then have it destroyed, you know? And I think that speaks to, like, I mean, so much today and things. And I'm wondering for you, Seth, and how you think about viewers, audience, participants, because a lot of the work that you've done seems so participatory and like people interacting and, you know, doing things. So, yeah, I think maybe start there with your thoughts on that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think I'm not really a joiner. I don't think I'm a great participator, really. So it's funny to have produced 10 years of work that doesn't really, a lot of the work we make doesn't really happen unless the audience take an active role in it. But I think for me, I say those two things next to each other because I try to respect the idea that I might be in the audience and actually not want to participate. So I create an invitation for the audience to participate that they don't have to, a true invitation, they don't have to say yes to. They can say no to, and that's a perfectly valid response and a valuable response. It's not, we have work where you can be an active participant or you can be a witness. And being a witness is as powerful and often more powerful than being an active participant. So I'm very, very careful of my audience in that sense. I care for them and respect them. In Arch, in some respects, it's actually less participatory than a lot of the work that I've made. And some people said to me, well, that's strange. Why are you making this work that is less participatory? And a very, very eminent theatre critic in the UK said, oh, no. It's not like that at all. It's clearly participative in the sense that you are witness in a very, very active way. Now, of course, anyone in an audience is a witness. But in Arch, you're seeing something very real happen in front of you. You're seeing two people build an architecture made two-thirds of concrete and one-third of ice. It inevitably will collapse. There is an inevitability to that. It is very, very real. And to some extent, it's a kind of death to the audience to watch, because you've told them what you're going to do. You're then going to do it in front of them, and they want to stay with it. That's up to them. It's like a invitation or a... and when we do it in public space, in the sense of we do it in the street or where we've done it in some places where it's very, very busy public space, it really is an invitation for people to get off a bus and they thought they were going home, and they stop and they watch us build an ice out of concrete and build an arch out of concrete and ice. And then they watch it for 45 minutes incrementally melt and fall over. And that for me is a huge success, that invitation is very real, I suppose, and that the participation is about witness. Additionally, in Arch, we invite people to sing. Interesting hearing Samantha talking about the catharsis of singing and the power of singing and joining in. We have this amazing score composed by our musical director, Verity Standen, and she works with people beforehand. And so we have secret singers, and so they join in. We call them secret singers. It's a kind of open secret. And they join in, and there are moments in the show where they join in, and it's thrilling, because it's thrilling as a performer because suddenly you get this amazing swell of sound. I mean, it's thrilling as an audience member because you are implicated. Even if you're not singing, the person beside you suddenly starts to sing, and so you relate to them because you're an audience member too. So that role of participation is important for me as well.
I would love to hear you speak about, I don't want to say symbolism, but the importance of the form of the arch. Like, what drew you to that form, and what does it mean for you in the work?
Yeah, it's a good question, because it's a kind of, in history, it's also politicized and it's used in religion and all sorts of things, but actually that wasn't it for me. For me, it was a metaphor. I was explaining to someone how I felt, and I felt very much like I'd been leaning on something that I then realized sort of wasn't in there in the way that I thought it was. And I literally used an arch to describe it. I said, it's a bit like an arch where a third of it is ice. And then I thought, oh, well, I could explore this more. So it was a sort of momentary description of a feeling of loss, I suppose, and a feeling of sort of things not being quite as they are, about the world as much as anything else. Every part of an arch relies on every other part of an arch in order to have its rather extraordinary form. So it's held in this tension by itself. So for me, it's a sort of rather beautiful form because of that. It has this tension that is sort of undeniable. I find it very beautiful as a form, and it obviously collapses in this show. So for me, that sense of loss creates quite an interesting emotional journey for the audience that maybe they're also a bit surprised about, I think. Again, because we sort of told them what's going to happen. But then when it actually happens, I think the effort that you describe that they've witnessed over time, the commitment that they've made to the performance. It's like it's 2 hours long. You know, that is a commitment. Actually, there is a sense of loss in it, which is quite real.
It's making me think of this book that I've been reading recently called, this book that I'm currently reading called Acts of Resistance, The Power of Art for Social Change, or something like this. And it, the author, I'm forgetting her name right now, talks mainly about theater work as these sort of agents of change and showing us something about the world, maybe not explicitly as straightforward political resistance, but showing us this, you know, metaphors and things. So I'm thinking about Arch and what that means when the pieces, like the keystone, falls, and how necessary, what, as you're saying, all of the pieces are. And this, you know, this question that we have today in this world, I think it's always ongoing, but feels incredibly urgent about interdependence and what it means to be in this like global community and things like that. So I think it's, you know, like interpersonally and personally, and also collectively, what level do you tend to think about that piece on?
I mean, that's a really good articulation of how I think about it, what you've just said. I mean, I think about it as a global systems metaphor. So my experience of audiences watching it is that, well, just to go back a little bit. So what happens in Arch is you witness two people build an arch out of concrete and ice. Whilst they do that, you have this very beautiful voice from four or five singers sing throughout the whole time without stopping. So you hear this breath that's very present. And then it inevitably melts and falls over, and that's what you witness. For me, it's about global systems in the sense that it could be about human created systems like democracy. It could be the internet, it could be financial systems. But also it's about life. It's also about us and our life's cadence and renewal. And so what it does is, in the time when the arch is standing and you as an audience are with it for that time, it might fall at any moment. That's very real for us. We can't tell you when it's going to fall. And in that moment, you sit with your own thoughts about the world, and often they turn to your own life and yourself as well. So it can be very, very personal response, but it also can be a much bigger global systems sort of metaphor as well. And for me, its success has been where people are drawing a line between their own personal individual sense of what it means to this arch to fall over and what it means in our world right now, globally.
And I'd like to turn now to Julianne to talk about being a performer in Samantha's work too, and sort of, you know, your experience of being an individual within this work, and how it impacts you, and like what the experience is for you as a dancer, a mover, you know, embodying this work.
Thank you. I would just go one time back to all that you were speaking out about before, also Seth, that it is quite amazing how we can feel the sense of what's going on in the world and what's going on within us by watching such a performance and being invited to experience our own life a little bit, our own point of view, our own state of mind. And then I'll connect that with thanking you and also Meredith, and bring it into what I've experienced in working with Sam at this performance of life in this house is over. First of all, the theme of grief or loss can leave you isolated, can leave you feeling alone, can leave you recognizing all of your losses and griefs in your own life. And I think that that was my personal relationship very quickly, because my father passed during this process, which gave me beauty and a reality very strong. And I'm forever grateful for that. So if I can go directly to what my dance, my little moment of movement or extension of words through my body or poetry in space with my body, how that happened and how that grew and how that was developed had a lot to do with those questions, that isolation, that real feeling of loss. And again, I appreciate that, because although I don't consider it therapeutic in any way, it was quite reality. And I was more confronted with the reality than the illusion of it, which is what we're always dealing with, I think, in theater and life and everything. Where's the illusion? Where's the reality? Of course, working with Sam has been exciting. I'm really a fan, because she has brought her, I guess, her love and her passion to wish to study, come to Germany and study this company or study this legend or learn about all the processes or inquire. This feeling of inquiry was very exciting for me to encounter and to meet. And I really felt like I've grown in this performance a lot. It's been something that also, when we go back to the ideas of singing these polyphonic songs that we were also doing all together as part of the training and moving towards the final creation, I think was a huge part of where we can say the voyage is so beautiful even before you get to the actual result. So we had a lot of training together in that. I also wanted to bring out the point that in this idea of singing together, you're reaching many different tonalities that touch the soul. And that's also something that I think really became very rich for me, as each time I would sing or join in, eventually maybe not singing every song, but the voyage that we went on is still within us. And it's very, I think, inevitable to see in all of the performers in this piece.
So many thoughts. First of all, I'm so sorry for your loss.
It's okay. I mention it with great joy and with great gratitude, because I think we all have loss. And it was particularly my story there. And I was able to really see the poetry within it. And Samantha really gave me the chance to make it alive and make it beautiful. That's for sure.
And I think that makes me think of Samantha, what you were saying earlier about, dealing with issues and themes of loss and grief, it doesn't always, sometimes text-based talking it out processes don't always get at the heart of the matter, I guess, to say. And so your experience, Julianne, of sort of living the work during that time. And for me, as, a viewer of work, there's something that happens for me when I'm watching something and I can really feel that the what is being expressed is really lived in the dance or the theater piece or whatever. And I would really love, I'm hoping to get to the performance this weekend. So I just really love to see that and witness that. It's just powerful thinking about being a performer and then being an audience of performance and being able to process things in ways that actually get embodied.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that I think Pina Bausch did amazingly well, was like you really feel watching her work that someone is really saying something, or something is fully embodied. And that was also what was really cool about my collaboration with Julie, because she worked with Pina Bausch for decades. And also Julie Shanahan, who's in the cast, is that I learned a lot from collaborating with both of them, because they come in with like ideas, and they're always very personal, even if they're not personal. There's something from their life, and I think that was one thing with Julie, this Julie in particular, was I remember the day you brought in the scene about your father. And I think that that's one of the things that's really different from like traditional American theater. And this was something, I recently did a fellowship at the Yale School of Drama, and I was talking with a professor about this. I was like, when a performer brings something that personal, one cannot like criticize or dissect it as if it's a character on a page, because it would overly expose that person, right? So it's this kind of like very sacred, beautiful thing that also comes through friendship, I would say. It was also
Sure.
like, wow, you trust me with that. That's an honor. Let me take care of it. And of course, we're also objective about the work. You know, it's not therapy, like you say, but there's a ferocity also to working that way,
Sure.
to bring that much to the table. And I think that's a very unique way of working. And I, as a young director, learned a lot from the way Julie came to the rehearsal with that material, you know. And I also saw other performers who were maybe younger or who had never been around that kind of way of working go, wow, that's the amount of thought you can put into something. That's the amount of detail that, and that's the amount of like guts you can also put into something. But it's sort of protected by this poetry, right? And one other thing I just wanted to add to what you said is, when we also worked in Wrocław at the Grotowski Institute, and we got to watch this amazing interview with Peter Brook, where he introduced the American public to Acropolis when it came to La Mama. And he said something about like, to refer to something like realistically is to refer to it as if it already happened. So there's an argument that it never happened. But when you somehow create the feeling of something, the audience cannot deny that it has occurred. And I think that was a, I mean, I'm grossly like simplifying what was a gorgeous 10-minute, you know, articulation by Peter Brook. But to me, that was sort of like, oh, you just explained like the kind of theater I like to make, you know? So yeah.
May I add one thing, if you don't mind? We have time.
Yes.
And is where one, if I may make my point clear, where one personal experience, or in my case, bringing in the real reality of my life, at one point it becomes universal. It becomes something that is no more private, but something that goes so deep in the state of that performer that everyone can see it. Now you're invited to live it, or you're invited to feel it. And if you resist it, like we all can do in theater, then you do that. But maybe you go home reeling, well, why did I resist that? And you knew exactly why. But the state and the truth of it and the authenticity of it makes it become extremely universal and very much an invitation, and very much, I think, a courageous act for both sides. And I think that's also a major reason, or one of the aspects of the way they have described, as they always have to, why Pina Bausch received the Kyoto Prize in 2007, because they need to make a statement, and that had much to do with how she could make this reciprocal act constantly happen between what that was happening on the stage, those state of the performers, be it through dance, be it through a text, be it through a song, what state are they in that goes into universality, and the audience is absolutely right there with you. As if what was my first impression when I first saw the company way back when I was a ballet dancer in Holland, and I thought, but it's that's me. I know exactly what they feel. That's what I want to do too. Look at her. Look at the way she moves. Well, I understand inside me, in feeling so maybe childish or innocent or naive in the moment, but going home obsessed and not being able to describe it at the same time.
Yes, Seth. And then I would like to get people info about how they can see these incredible works. But Seth, yes.
I mean, it's really powerful listening to you, Samantha and Julie. Julie, I have a question for you, which is about what you just described there was, in fact, both of you, I guess, is that how you describe it. And even listening to myself, it's quite an intense experience going to the theatre for the audience. There's quite a lot going on. And I'm very grateful for that because where else do we find that? There's a grain to that that I absolutely love. You go somewhere and you're transformed. At the best, you go somewhere and you're transformed in a way that you never leaves you. So I guess my question, Judy, is like, how much of what you talk about there is about liveness? Because I'm so aware of in this absolutely accelerated AI world, but actually this live moment, and Samantha, you talked about kind of the ancient act of theatre, you know, like the ceremony of it, that somewhere in this sharing this space and putting yourself on the line as a performer, like it's very real. What you're describing is a realness, as far as I'm concerned, not a fiction. Although, of course, it's within some kind of fictitious frame because you might repeat something of it the following night kind of thing. It's a practice or a rehearsal for tomorrow or whatever, however you describe it. But it's not like it is also gone in that moment. Like it's also ephemeral, right? So my question is, how much of what you're saying there is, I guess, about the liveness of your experience as a performer?
I mean, for me, it's all about the liveness, and it's all about being in that moment at the highest potential you can possibly be at, follow a little bit the structure, know what we have to do, know where it came from, pulling up in the moment the truth of it. I know that sounds very, very, I don't know, maybe cliche, but it's really true. I mean, asking yourself the question upon the moment you're doing it. Is it too much? Is it too little? Is it what I had to say? Is I'm following along and being totally there? And in that moment, within that reality, I think that's what resonates. And that's what gives it so much the liveness that no other situation other than that could give.
And just to add as well, and I think this speaks to, you know, your piece, the structure sounds incredible of your piece. I, as a director, think my job is to make a very strong structure so that the performers are free, you know, especially when dealing with autobiographical material. Dealing with autobiographical material, structure is a way of like actually like trauma-informed emotional safety, actually. But also it's a way in which I like to think like you have a net for all of your like cosmic chaos to like rail against.
Yeah.
Because I'm also trained as an actor, so I think that way, you know, and that's also what makes it great for the audience, hopefully, a good structure.
Sure.
You know, I think that's also Pina Bausch, like she knew good structure, you know. And I think that is what I think, yeah, really strong structure allows the unexpected to happen. Like also your piece, like you said, like they know what's gonna happen, but then it comes. Right? That's really good structure.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think, and one might assume that that makes something less alive, but it's not so, in my opinion, you know. So.
I think anticipation is a huge part of liveness, and we invite anticipation in a lot of situations, perhaps also in yours, Seth, with ours.
Yeah, nice. Thank you both. That's a really nice response. Thank you.
So for our listeners, how can people come to these, what do people need to do to come to these performances? So we have Samantha Shea's work, Life in This House is Over, premiering in the U.S. this weekend, Friday, August 15th, Saturday, August 16th at 8 p.m., and then the group Polyphonic Singing at 3 p.m. on Saturday, correct?
Yes.
Correct.
So how can people get tickets for that?
So you can go to our website. I'm so glad you asked, Meredith. You can go to our website, which is P for Peter, S21Chatham.org, and it's right there. There are tickets available still for both nights. And it's the same information, different dates. But well, I'll let you do your run-up for Seth there. Sorry, before I don't want to repeat. I'm not going to repeat the website. Yeah, different times. But you go, Meredith. Sorry.
It's all good here. We are friends. And then Seth, yours is at the end of the month. So is it Saturday, August 30th and Sunday, August 31st? At 7:30 p.m., correct?
Is that right, Vallejo?
I believe that's correct. of course, I say that. I didn't think to have the website open in front of me. But, yeah, that's Labor Day weekend, so it's the last weekend of the summer. So we're not normally known for Sunday night performances, but I think this weekend, just being that holiday weekend, we thought it was a great idea. And there are performances from Basinga in the afternoon leading up to the presentation of Arch. It's also, it coincides with the county fair down the road, and Samantha Shea, Samantha's performance coincides with Crellin Park Day. So there's a kind of whole suite of experiences to have in Chatham both these weekends. It's really exciting.
Maybe get like play the like duck game at the fair and then come over and experience, you know, some powerful
you can practice. You can practice knocking things down at the fair and then, you know, or chainsawing. Maybe we need to bring some chainsaws into the show, Seth. Make it more thematic.
We don't need to make it anymore.
Absolutely come and see our work over at PS21 that weekend. I'm very happy to say as well, in between these two extraordinary works, on the weekend of the 22nd and then the 24th of August, we have a beautiful concert from the pianist Adam Tendler, who's played at PS21 before. He is performing a work called Inheritances, where he inherited inexplicably a substantial quantity of cash and used all of that money to commission, I think, a dozen different composers to write work for him. And he performs them all. Some of the composers are coming. And then on Sunday, we have a screening of Stop Making Sense, which is part of a series that Marissa Neff, the new executive director of the Crandall Theatre in town, has built, and she DJs just before the screening. So Stop Making Sense, people will know, is the beautiful, beautiful documentary about David Byrne.
Excellent. And Samantha, where can people find more information about you and your work?
I have a website, SamanthaShea.art, is a great place to stay up to date. And I'm on Instagram. you can just look me up, Samantha_Shea. Yeah.
And Julie, where can people find out more about you?
I'm also on Instagram. I'm STNZKJ. So it's my name without the A's, but you can find me. It's connected. And I post a lot of things also from Sam. So
great. And then Seth, what about you?
If you just search Seth Honor on the internet, you'll get me because I think I'm the only one there. And my organization is called Kaleider, KALEIDER.com.
Great. Thank you all so much for this conversation. And I'm really looking forward to the work. Thank you.
Thanks, Meredith.
Thanks
Sam.
Us.
Thanks, Seth.
Seth, Vallejo, thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Well, thanks, Julie.
90.7 FM.
Acra, Hudson, Catskill.